This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media Technology News Network. We're about to speak to William A. Draves, who's the co-author with Julie Coates of Nine Shift, Work, Life, and Education in the 21st Century. Welcome to Utopia Media Technology News Network.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
You're the president of a network yourself, the Learning Resources Network. Tell us what LERN is.
Yes. Well, Learning Resources Network is an international association in lifelong learning, and we do consulting for a variety of organizations doing continuing education and lifelong learning, like colleges and schools and recreation departments and museums and anybody out there doing classes or events for adults.
All right. And how did your activity in that area lead you to the research, the conclusions, and the publication of Nine Shift?
Well, a good question, Mark. We were headquartered in Manhattan, Kansas, and we had a big headquarters, offices, and staff. And the chair of our board said, there's this thing called the Internet, and go find out what it's about. And when I did, found out about intranets and how you could do a virtual office. And so we left, kind of blew up, figuratively, our national headquarters and went to a virtual office. And we now have staff all over the country in Portland, Oregon, and Providence, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin, and Colorado, and other places. So that was one of the motivations for Nine Shift, was simply the transition that my family and myself and my organization was going through from the 20th century to the 21st century.
So you make the point that you're essentially living in the future already.
Yeah, everything we talk about is the present for us, and Julie even says it's the past. That
right.
is, it's happened.
Right.
So, indeed, living fairly differently in some respects from most Americans.
And in fact, what you're doing in the book is taking the lessons that you've learned personally and in your business and expanding them on the societal level to see what kind of changes the whole country is likely to undergo.
Exactly, and we're not alone. The changes that we talk about in Nine Shift, telecommuting from home, using a virtual office, networks as an organization, trains replacing cars, we're seeing other people using these as well, and we're seeing growth in numbers in all of those areas.
Okay, so, yes. Let's try to talk about the function of ideas in moving history forward.
Mm-hmm.
What essentially you've done is observed changes, you've given them names, you've put them into a pattern, and you're then feeding that back to everyone to help them understand what the transition is like as a way of facilitating it. Would that be a fair analysis?
Exactly, yes.
What do you say is the single biggest idea in Nine Shift? And before you tell us that, what does Nine Shift as a title and a concept refer to?
Yeah. Nine Shift refers to the idea that we have about 12 hours of discretionary time.
Right.
We need to sleep. We need to eat. And that nine of those 12 hours are going to be spent entirely differently in 2020 than we spent those 9 hours in 2000.
So essentially, your real life is those 9 hours that you've got every day to do what you do.
Yes.
And
we say that because in 1920, people spent those 9 hours entirely differently than they did in the year 1900.
Okay, let's get to that in a second and the parallels between the centuries. But what would you say is the biggest single idea in your book, if you could encapsulate it?
The biggest single idea is that the Internet as a technology is creating economic forces to change our lives.
Okay.
And that these things are overwhelming. That is, we don't vote on them. There's no one person that's going to say yes or no to them. They're just transforming our lives.
Okay, I just wanted to throw in a sort of anecdote about that. As I switch back and forth between the Internet and television and radio
mm-hmm.
all day in combination and separately and so on, at the end of almost every radio program and every television program now, it says, go to our website and get more stuff. And I'm thinking, why settle for the – why? That's convergence in a way. Why listen to the radio or watch television if you can have everything on the – if everyone's sending everyone to the Internet?
Yes, and we are clearly moving towards that time when television and radio will be delivered via the Internet or be so, as you say, converged that it won't make a difference.
And in fact, when I put this interview with you up on our website, it will be the functional equivalent of radio. And I'm in a negotiation now with a company that's going to make it possible to do a video, and maybe we're going to do another interview in a week or two in video, and then it'll essentially be television, and it'll all be here on the Utopia Media website and millions of others as well. So
yeah, I listen to about 10 different radio stations, but 6 of them are online.
Okay. Let's focus on one of the main points that you make in the beginning of the book, that the best way to understand the next 20 years at the beginning of the 21st century is to take a look at the first 20 years of the last, the 20th century. How did you reach the conclusion, and what's the evidence and logic behind what you say in that regard?
Well, the big change for me is when I went to a small town in Kansas and saw the changes that that small town had gone through from 1900 to 1920, and then to see all over the evidence that that wasn't just one little town, that was how America lived. And that was the aha when I knew the Internet was changing life today.
And in fact, what was it? There was also a technological change at the around 1900.
Yes.
That you compare with the change of the Internet now.
Yes, it was the automobile.
Ah, the automobile. And how central to the old economy, the 20th century economy, is the automobile, would you say?
Absolutely critical, essential. Automobile created mass production in the factory work and is tied to it and tied to offices. And just as manufacturing is going out of date as a 20th century phenomenon, so too are automobiles.
And in fact, if you, on the legacy media, television, it's almost wall-to-wall commercials for television. Implicitly for television, but for automobiles. I mean, that seems to be the bulk of primetime advertising and daytime advertising as well. Well, what is the significance of that as a legacy of the 20th century? And what do you see as the future of automobiles in the age of the Internet?
Well, automobiles, television, factories, all related to the 20th century and all becoming obsolete. Some of the changes you don't notice, for instance, between 1900 and 1910, the sale of carriages and buggies only declined 10%.
Right.
And then you had this steep drop-off. So it seems like automobiles aren't in steep decline yet, but in fact they are. Automobiles, the key with the automobile is you can't work and drive.
Right. Say that a few more times and stress the importance of that.
Yeah.
Because they're quote putting the Internet in cars now.
Yes, they are.
And kids
they tried to put automobiles into carriages 100
right.
years ago.
Right.
Now they're trying to put the Internet in cars. The thing that they can't do is allow you to work and drive at the same time.
In your own personal automobile where you have to drive. That's different than trains or even possibly buses equipped with Wi-Fi.
Exactly. And this past year is the first year that they put wireless Internet connections on airplanes. The first airline was Lufthansa.
Right.
Within the last 12 months, we've also seen wireless connections on trains. England has about 100 trains now with wireless, and they're predicting in 20 years that 600 million Europeans will travel by trains with wireless.
So that means Harry Potter and his colleagues could do some of their early spell work on their train on the way to Hogwarts now if they were hooked up.
Yeah,
if they brought along their laptops.
Yeah, you could decide to wake up in L.A. and have lunch in San Francisco and be home by supper and work all the way to San Francisco and all the way home wireless online.
Stress the point you make about how time spent working while traveling is not time wasted.
Right. Well, when you are working and traveling, you could say, how long does it take to get from L.A. to San Francisco? Well, it doesn't take any time hardly at all because you're working all the way.
Because essentially your work environment is you carry it around with you.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's because the predominant workforce in the 21st century is the knowledge worker, the person who uses his brains.
Or her brains. Right.
Yes. Quite clearly, that is evolving as the only work sector where you can have a middle-class lifestyle, support a family in a post-industrial society such as the United States.
Okay. Now, in addition to working while traveling, people, as you stress in Nine Shift, are going to be working at home also.
Right.
How does the new technology make that possible? And then let's sort of branch out from that and see what kind of changes that's going to bring.
Yeah. Well, the reason why companies will send workers home, right now workers want to work at home. About half of all workers say they would like to work from home. And there's all sorts of personal, family, leisure reasons for that, good reasons. But companies will start to figure this out, that they can't afford to have 25% of their employees' time wasted driving to and from a computer.
Right.
And so it's a win-win for companies and employees to have their employees work from home, save 3 hours a day in commuting time, and essentially split that. People who work from home actually work longer than people who work in offices.
But paradoxically, they still have more time to be with their family and in their communities.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Now,
because
right. Go ahead.
They're saving that kind of time.
Okay. Now, there are some legacy objections raised to working at home that it makes people lonely and isolated. What do you say to that?
Well, we have numerous examples of how it connects people to families. There is a legitimate argument that we have destroyed community in our neighborhoods.
Because essentially everyone gets in their car, drives downtown or out to the suburbs, works, and the physical community is deserted for most of those 9 hours during the day.
Yes, and consciously or unconsciously, business has transferred that social interaction, the birthday parties and those things, to the office.
Right.
But we had community 50 years ago, and that can be reinstilled and reinstalled, that sense of community, those getting to know neighbors and all those things, civic clubs, all of that can be rebuilt in a very short period of time.
Okay. Now, why are people still working in offices then? When do you expect they'll stop? And what do you see as the process by which that transition is going to take place?
Yeah. Good questions. One factor is simply generational. That is, baby boomers have been raised going to the office. The bosses are baby boomers who don't understand virtual offices and have a fear of supervising people from a distance. And so one of that is the generational transition as Gen Y moves into the workplace and Gen Xers become work leaders. That is going to impact it. The other factor is simply competitive business. When one or two businesses start to move to the 21st century model, others are going to have to in order to remain competitive.
Now, of course, that also applies on the national level too, doesn't it?
National and international.
And international. The big work groups, if we can call them that, that are organized, the ones that work according to 21st century standards will succeed, and the ones that work according to 20th century standards won't.
That's right. Absolutely correct.
There's a good theoretical way of understanding this that comes from Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, in which he says that the way a new paradigm is put in is that the people who believe in the new paradigm, who live within it, then take over the institutions or create new institutions, and the people who believe in the old paradigm essentially go off the stage, and the new paradigm takes over that way.
Yes.
And that's just what you've described here for Gen Y, Gen X, baby boomers, and the transition to a home-based economy.
Right.
Yeah. So after that happens, when more and more people are working at home, what corresponds to that in terms of hierarchies versus networks, and what's the impact of that on that process, and what's the importance of that transition from hierarchies to networks?
Yeah. Once you start working from home, and once your organization is web-based, you see the world entirely different. And one of those changes, as you say, is the transition from pyramids to networks. And we're seeing how pyramids and hierarchies are no longer functional. Even in the national defense area, you're seeing how some of our military organizations are talking about shifting to a network structure.
This is essentially special forces versus infantry.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Intelligence units.
Right. Even the Army of One slogan that the Defense Department
mm-hmm.
uses is
yes.
it corresponds to this.
Yeah, and you can see the language start to change as well. So that's happening in a variety of different areas.
Why are networks superior to hierarchies?
Information. In a hierarchy, information goes through channels and gets cut off and has to go from one to another. In a network, everyone shares information with everyone else.
Okay, and distinguish between push and pull information and how networks work to facilitate the right kind of information exchange.
Yeah, in a push environment, I tell you what I think you need to know. And I don't have any idea what you need to know, even if we're in the same organization, even if I'm supervising you. In a pull information network, you tell me what you need to know.
Or you put the information up on the intranet, and everyone who needs to get certain pieces of it goes and gets it.
Yes. When you need to know something about me or what I'm doing, you go to our mutual intranet and you pull it down.
What does this mean for the future of staff meetings?
We'll continue to have staff meetings. We will have online staff meetings which revolve around information. Face-to-face is obsolete for sharing information. Because of what we just talked about, the whole push and pull thing.
Right, but it still is essential for certain other functions, which are what?
Team building, establishing long-term relationships, motivation. There's a variety of things that you can only do face-to-face or that you can do better face-to-face. And so we will still have face-to-face meetings, environments, sales meetings, meetings with customers, etc.
Okay, now as a sort of offshoot of what you just said about information going on to intranets and then being pulled down by people when they need it, what are the implications about that for privacy? You have a take on privacy that's a little different than say some traditional civil libertarians seem to have these days. What's your view about how crucial it is that information be kept private and the distinction between having access to information or using information for nefarious purposes?
Yeah. Well, we have to create a new infrastructure in the 21st century, and privacy a big issue, and we don't have an infrastructure that protects people and yet shares information. So that's one of the things that we're going to go see. But let's use two examples. One is health. Where right now, if I have a obscure disease, I'm saying I need to have that private or else I won't be able to get insurance, my boss will fire me,
right.
My neighbors won't talk to me. We need an infrastructure or laws that says, A, society needs to know when I have an obscure disease because, A, we need to cure that disease,
right.
And, B, we need to prevent other people from getting it.
Right.
So it's in everyone's interest to have so-called private information shared.
And, in fact, you make the same case in terms of, say, learning disabilities or learning patterns, that everyone's grades, in a sense, should be available so that the society as a whole can remediate these kind of issues.
Yes, and help each person achieve their maximum potential in a learning environment.
And to do that, you're saying that information about people needs to be more widely available for people to analyze or to essentially, I see you're having trouble with addition. Maybe you'd like our product.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right.
And then the second part of that thing is, okay, I'm going to share my health information, but we're also going to have laws that says, no, I can't be denied insurance. My employer can't fire me. My neighbors can't catcall me down the street cause me any harm, even verbally. So we need laws then that protect people, saying, yeah, the information is accessible, but you can't harm this person. You can't do anything to this person in a negative way because of this information.
Okay, let's focus on the question of high density housing. Okay. Now, here in
I do just one historical parallel
please,
to this whole health privacy
please
thing?
Please.
Yeah, well, 100 years ago, it was legal to have your own private army, then, as we went into the 20th century, we said, wait a minute, you can't just have an army and go start a little private war.
Right.
And so Brinks and Pinkertons were private armies.
Right.
And then we made laws saying, no, you can't have an army. So this idea of, can we make a law saying, you know, protecting people from on the information side, yes, we can do that.
Okay. On the subject of high-density housing, now here in California in the legislature, there are efforts afoot to set up tax incentives and other regulations that would encourage building more housing in denser configurations around transportation centers. Now, that's obviously a point that you address in your book, but you make the point that that's not going to work unless people are working at home. What's the relationship between high-density housing around transportation nodes as an idea and the way to achieve it, either through legislation or whether it's more important that people be working at home and that sets in motion economic forces that will actually make people want to live in high-density housing without the need to legislate it?
Yeah, and it's all the economic forces. Legislation will not do anything to change housing patterns of significance.
Okay.
It's welcome, but that's not what's going to happen and is happening. It's the economic forces.
What's the relationship then between more people wanting to work at home, companies wanting people to work at home, and the creation of a transportation node-centric housing pattern?
Yeah. Well, once you work at home, time becomes so valuable that you don't want to waste time. We talked about driving to work,
right.
But people spend more time driving to shopping and doing those things. That's even on a higher increase in terms of time.
Right.
And so when you work at home, you want things in a very small area around you.
Right.
So you can get to them and get back. It's not cost effective to drive 30 minutes to save $5.
This, in fact, is why cities came into being in the first place.
Mm, okay.
And then they went out to the suburbs with the commuting. But you're saying now essentially they're going to be drawing back into concentrations, higher concentrations, at a different level because the work will be done electronically, but the living will be done locally.
Yes, and we're already seeing that transition in terms of baby boomers retiring. They are moving downtown for the nightclubs and the restaurants and those kinds of things. And then we will very shortly see Generation Y move downtown for the very same reasons.
So again, what you're saying is that the aggregation of sort of interactions that people have, that they carry around them as a kind of bubble, when these aggregate, they create new economic and social and even cultural manifestations.
Yes.
Okay. Enlarge on that a little bit more and talk about what you see as the new social arrangements and wealth distribution patterns that you think will be emerging from these changes.
Well, the wealth pattern is now very unequal. The average average CEO makes something like 400 times the average worker.
Right.
And we haven't seen this kind of inequality for 100 years.
Right, right.
So even during the Great Depression, the ratio was only 12 to 1. In 1960, it was 20 to 1. Peter Drucker says that's the ideal ratio because that's when we had the greatest prosperity and the greatest middle class.
Right.
And so we will start to build that infrastructure back in, health insurance, universal education and college, and those kinds of things that will lessen the inequality of wealth.
Is part of the reason for that is like this: in a hierarchical situation, in some sense, it's understood that the person, in this case, I would almost say almost always the man at the top, is so crucial. He's 400 times more important to the success of the operation than the factory worker who makes limited decisions. But in the networked economy, in the knowledge worker economy, there is in fact a more diffuse distribution of the importance factor of how crucial individual decision makers are to the process, so that the value added is in fact more widely distributed among the workers, and the need to channel the information up, make the decision, channel the decision down, as that disappears, the fact of who's contributing to the operation, when that's reflected in the wealth distribution, it will be more egalitarian. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, I've never thought of it that way or never stated it that way.
Okay.
But indeed, that is another another reason why this inequality will start to lessen, that the quote average knowledge worker has to have so much education and be taken care of and can contribute so much to the network and the organization.
And in fact, again, distributing social resources throughout the net to the vast range of people who are in the network will facilitate their work and thereby create more productivity and greater wealth overall, so that by channeling a larger proportion of the resources to the people who are actually, quote, doing the work will be done better and there'll be more wealth and so on in a virtuous cycle.
Exactly. That having a greater balance of wealth will increase profitability of companies as well as provide the consumer base out there.
Now, presumably this would also apply in politics. Instead of having the leader who makes all the decisions and the followers who do all the following, people would be empowered politically in the same way through networks, and therefore more of the decision-making authority would reside lower down in the more throughout the network instead of being concentrated at the top of a hierarchy.
Yeah. Can I make one more historical parallel?
Please.
On that economic balance?
Sure.
Because, you know, for folks saying, you know, this is way off the wall.
Sure.
I mean, it happened before. Henry Ford all of a sudden doubled the salary of his workers.
Right.
And he did it for purely economic reasons, so they could afford cars, and so that they could have better standard of living, and that swept out through society and created the new middle class of the 20th century. So that kind of thing that we were just talking about, that has happened before. And so, yes, it can and will happen again.
Okay, now we're going to sort of come full circle here. Talk about the role of lifelong learning in this process and your concept of what I've abbreviated to ILAs, or individual learning accounts, that you present in Nine Shift.
Yeah. Well, lifelong learning, the idea that you learn throughout your life and certainly throughout your working life, is even more important now and in the 21st century. That is, information becomes goes out of date ever more quickly. New information is being created all the time. And one of the things that I suggest is sort of like a Social Security account for learning in the 21st century, which is an individual learning account, so that between the employee and the employer and future employers and government for certain kinds of low-income people, there are monies available to pursue learning, whether it's formal or informal, to continually update one's knowledge, and I call that an individual learning account. Actually, the idea was created in Great Britain and has been around for almost 10 years.
And that would follow the person, because from job to job or project to project, because as you say, this whole paradigm is going to mean that instead of working for one company for 40 years, people are going to essentially form collaborative teams, work on a project, and then add that to their resume and then go to their next project.
Yeah, a job is like a gig.
Right.
And that's mutually beneficial. That's not a negative. It keeps the company flexible, and it gives the individual opportunities for new challenges and growth and development.
Okay. You also focus on the centrality of online and web-based learning. What are you actually doing with that at Learn, and generally speaking, how important is that going to be, and what's that going to do to educational institutions from kindergarten to postgraduate work?
Yeah. Well, online learning will be half of all learning in the 21st century. Already, at least 3 million people have experienced online learning, and it's growing by leaps and bounds in colleges and now schools. Essentially, it's flexible, it's convenient. For information, it's even better. You can learn at 2 in the morning if that's your peak learning time. There's a host of reasons why it is so successful and growing. And so that will be an essential feature of the workplace and education and lifelong learning place.
What are the reasons why and the reasons why not? The greatest professors or middle school algebra teachers shouldn't be able to video transmit their lectures, their seminars to a much wider audience than they do now? Or is the cachet and the economic value of saying only you few choice select students are going to be able to hear this person give his or her lecture about whatever? What are the forces working in the two directions there, would you say?
Well, I think the major force works towards sharing that information and knowledge with ever greater numbers of people. I mean, if you have a wonderful resource, a professor who can explain something, you want to get that word out to as many folks as possible. And the more you get it out to folks, the cheaper it becomes, and actually it benefits the professor and the institution by serving greater numbers of people. So,
okay. Yes,
I think that's more than the model than the elitist, we're only going to accept 20 people and we're not going to tell anybody else about this stuff.
Because in fact, the paradigmatical 20th century futurist Buckminster Fuller argued that wealth consists of material, energy, and information, and that there's a finite amount of material and energy, but there's an infinite amount of information, and the more that's spread, it multiplies the effectiveness of the energy matter and therefore constantly increases wealth. The more information is distributed more effectively through more networks.
Yeah. 100 years ago, we said everybody needs to go to high school, and we've done that. And in the 21st century, everybody will need to have the equivalent of a four-year college degree is one example of this information education need to share and make it more universal.
Okay. Now, you make the argument that the transition from 1900 to 1920 is pretty much going to be paralleled by the transition in 2000 to 2020, but won't the transactional speeds and the experiences generated by the new technology in the current era move things ahead a lot faster and even create a different dynamic of change especially because the fact of information dissemination is at the center of the current transformation, and by making that happen even faster, there are more nerve cells to glial cell, in a sense. There's a more concentrated ability to disseminate information faster, and that's going to change the dynamic. What do you think about that?
Well, it's just a guess, Mark, but
right.
You would think because information goes so much more quickly that we'd make the transition faster,
right.
And yet we're not.
Okay, why not?
We're basically where we were in 1905.
Right.
And my only guess as to why that is that society is so much more complicated today.
Right.
That we have to untie so many more strings.
Okay.
To reformulate the infrastructure than we did 100 years ago, so that the result is things change faster, but we've got more things to change, and so we're
okay.
proceeding, it seems, just about exactly as we did 100 years ago.
Okay, last question here. There doesn't seem to be much coverage in your discussion of greed, passion, violence, environmental collapse, dissolving or resurgent nationalism, tribalism, and other forces that could themselves disrupt the course of transition that you predict will arise from these new disruptive technologies. Should you be taking into account more the perennial limitations of human nature in your projections?
Well, it's a good question. And there will be some bad things that will happen. But we weren't able to speculate, much less predict what those things were. The other thing is that all of those things that you mentioned are superseded by those basic economic forces that we talk about and that occurred 100 years ago. So, you know, you had the pneumonia epidemic of 1919, you had World War One, but none of that superseded or caused those changes not to occur 100 years ago.
So you're saying economic determinism is even stronger than human nature?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're not going to vote, or one person isn't going to change it, or start a war, or do something that can change these economic forces. Exactly.
Okay. Why don't we wrap up by giving you a chance to just sort of restate the major premises of Nine Shift and tell us whether you're optimistic or otherwise about the future based on your analysis.
Yeah. Well, to start off with your last question, yes, I'm optimistic because life became better in the 20th century vis-a-vis the 19th century, and so that is happening again, and life will be better for our children and grandchildren than it was for us. We are on course towards transforming our society from the industrial age into the Internet age. The Internet leading to people working from home in knowledge jobs, and those leading to a variety of other changes that impact our lives. I would just say that these changes are happening very quickly, they're, in one sense, fun to watch and exciting to watch. And I would encourage everybody to stay in touch with not only the changes in their lives, but then to stay in touch with boys and kids, because those are the true natives of the 21st century and can show us some exciting, wonderful things that are happening in these changes.
This is what Margaret Mead meant when she wrote about pre and post-figurative cultures, and she said a big change that happened in the 20th century was that because of the technological advances, it was the young who were living in the future and had more to teach the old than the other way around, as it had been the case for all previous human history.
Fascinating.
Let's do what I mentioned the radio and television people do and give you a chance to send people to your website so people can get more information, buy the book, do whatever they want to do on your site.
Thank you. The website is nineshift.com, the number or word nine, followed by shift, one word, nineshift.com, and that's where we have more information. We have a almost daily weblog about the changes going on, the book, and other opportunities.
Okay, good. So we'll see each other in cyberspace soon, I hope.
Yes.
Thanks.
Good to be with you.
Thanks very much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, bye.